This week on the Shame Free Life Radio podcast station, you're in for a treat. If you love books, if you love manuscripts, if you love fiction, nonfiction, well, we have a treat for you. Stay tuned. You will not be disappointed.
Today is about the power of you.
We can be whatever we dream.
You're locked into another episode of 15 Minutes of Shame. Each week, we'll help you rebuild your life one brick at a time by addressing real life issues from a practical and biblical perspective.
I had to believe in myself like never before.
This is the Shame Free Radio Show.
Finding the solution to become the greatest.
And now your host, minister, author, grief and trauma support specialist, Dr. Ronald Zion Rose.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is it.
Good evening, good morning, good night, wherever you are, coast to coast from around the globe. You are locked inside of another installment right here on the Shame Free Life radio station. I am your host, Ronald Zion, and it's such a pleasure to be back with you once again. But we definitely, as I indicated earlier, we have a treat for you, and we're going to talk about the Black Cell. That's right, the Black Cell. But before we get into it, we're going to take a quick commercial break. And when we get back, please have your pad and your pens ready. And I can't wait until we interview this special guest, in-studio guest. Have you ever felt alone and life is out of control? Perhaps like a sailboat at sea in the midst of a tsunami. Well, you're not alone. Here at the Shame Free Life, LLC, we offer services in trauma recovery, crisis intervention, and empowerment coaching. We operate in integrity, confidentiality, empathy, with coaching ethics. Contact us at theshamefreelife.com or email us at contact@theshamefreelife.com. You may not be responsible for your injury, but you are responsible for your healing. Let us help you rebuild your life one brick at a time, because your life begins when you say so. And we are back. I want to introduce to some and present to others author Dr. Wendy Shire. And she is the author of The Black Cell. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us inside the Shame Free Life broadcast. Thank you so much. How are you today?
I'm doing well, Ron. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
I'm excited to be here.
Absolutely. No, the pleasure is all mine. So, before we get into the book that you penned that's already published and getting ready to be released, and what is the exact date of The Black Cell?
The book will be released on September 22nd, so in about 2 weeks.
September 22nd, 9/22. So
27.
Oh, 27.
9/27.
9/27.
Yes.
Okay, absolutely. Yes. 9/27. Yes. So before we get into the dynamics of the book, I just want to talk about you for a moment. So Wendy, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, who is Wendy Shire? We know that you are an author. We know that you are a doctor. You know, aside from those illustrious titles, who are you as an individual?
Well, I am a mom. Our family has 5 young people. We just became empty nesters. So we are about 2 weeks into empty nest life. So we are adjusting to that. I work at the University of Maryland School of Social Work. I run a center there. It's actually a blended center called the Social Work Community Outreach Service. And the other part of the center is Thomas Heights. We do a lot of work in Baltimore communities, really trying to address issues of structural racial oppression and the ensuing poverty and community challenges that have been caused in our city by a very long history of racialized policies and laws. So we do a lot of work in K-12 schools. We work at about 30 schools where we are supporting school leaders in creating a culture and climate that is loving and supporting and caring for children and families. We are really trying hard to break that school prison pipeline, especially for Black and brown kids. We do a lot of work around community organizing. We support pregnant moms, really trying to impact the Black maternal health crisis and pretty high rates of infant mortality that our team has been working on. So we are working in lots of different ways in the city, but our love, we are an unapologetically anti-racist organization, and our love is people and building relationships in a restorative way.
I love it. Thank you so much. You know, building relationships, and that's so important, especially when we talk about our community. When we talk about our neighborhoods, we just call it hood. We don't even, we just cut off the neighbor part and we just go with just hood.
That's right.
Let me ask you a question. Right. Before we get into the dynamics of the book, when did you first recognize that you had a gift of writing? Obviously you have the gift as far as academia, and so many things that, as far as you being actively involved, boots on the ground within the community, services or wraparound services of participating with that. But when did you first recognize, you know what, I have a gift with this pen in my hand?
You know, I don't know that. that's actually a great question. And nobody's asked me that. I actually don't know that I ever really recognized that I had a gift. I will tell you that I've always enjoyed writing fiction. It was something I used to do for fun when I was younger, and but not seriously. And I remember being in my late 20s and trying to write a book. But, you know, interestingly enough, I realized now that I didn't have enough life experience. I didn't have stuff to write about that was really meaningful. And so I actually became a serious writer after the age of 50. So for those of you out there who want to write, it is never too late. I started really writing. I read about a woman who was 72 when she started writing. And I thought, well, goodness, if she can do it, then I can do it too. So I don't think that there was ever a moment where I said I have a gift. But I will tell you that I wrote this particular book out of an outpouring of grief that happened quite organically after Freddie Gray was killed. And I was just really just, I was overcome with grief. And then the grief continued with the ongoing killing of Black people, which, you know, we know has been happening for a very long time, but now we have the benefit of getting to see it played over and over and over again on the internet or on the news. And I really started writing just because I had nowhere to put that grief. So it wasn't an actually formed idea that, oh, I'm going to write a book. It was more like, I need to write this stuff down. Where am I going to write it? And I started writing. And that's really where it started. It was more of a response than a plan.
Okay. I totally understand. You mentioned Freddie Gray. And of course, you know, this is the countless lives and names of so many, Sandra Bland, etc. But Freddie Gray, it really struck me in such a way as well. Even though I'm here in North Carolina, miles cannot separate the sorrow and the grief and certainly the trauma as it relates to what happened. Let me ask you this question from an author standpoint, a mother, and just, you know, and what you do in the academic circle, do you feel that, and I'm so grateful that we do have we have the opportunity, we have the liberty to be able to see everything in real time. I think that sometimes it can be a double-edged sword, whether it's Facebook Live or whether it's YouTube, etc., to be able to get information that maybe perhaps years before, 40 years before, was concealed, but now the dirt that's being done in communities is now revealed, perpetrated against Black and brown people. Do you feel, or do you think, that oftentimes when we see of violence that's perpetrated against our communities in such a manifold manner that oftentimes we become desensitized by seeing it over and over again, whether it's in real time or in replay.
Yeah, you know, I have wondered about that a lot. I will tell you, I don't have a clear answer for that. I have spent a lot of time thinking about the impact of continuing to see those images over and over again of Black bodies being abused, of being dragged, being killed, being thrown down and pinned over and over again. I definitely think that has an impact on us. At the same time, I am challenged by the idea that I have the privilege of just turning it off and walking away, mm-hmm. which my ancestors did not have the privilege of doing, right? I mean, I know that my ancestors, and likely yours, didn't have that opportunity. They had to live it. They had to walk through it. In some ways, it is a privilege to be able to turn it off. And in some ways, there are some times when I force myself to look at it so that I don't ever forget. But it is a double-edged sword, because at some point you have to protect yourself, and you have to protect your heart and your psyche, and you have to protect your children from seeing those things. And then we constantly have to translate for our kids what they're seeing, what they're hearing on the news. And that can be very challenging. But the reality is that Black children don't have the luxury of growing up innocent. And neither do their parents. And so, you know, it is something that I am always trying to balance, both for myself, so that I can be healthy and strong, and also so that I can continue to support the people around me who are being impacted on a daily basis by this. So it is hard. You know, it's really hard, Ron, to figure out what is the right approach. I think each person has to do some self-interrogation about what they need. But if we don't ever want to see it, then we also have to understand what that means, too. Is it that we don't want to see it because it's so painful? We'd rather forget it, which I totally understand. So it's difficult. I don't think there is a clear answer to that question.
I totally agree with you. I'm certainly on board with you. Dr. Cher, I think this is a perfect segue. You mentioned that that you were prompted after the abuse and mishandling and a broken back of Freddie Gray, and how it affected you and the community at large, of just seeing this secondary trauma, because that's what it was. We're going to call it what it was within the community. Yeah. Those who were not directly connected to him were affected by what he was impacted by, that prompted you to move into a different vein as far as committing yourself to writing. I guess it's a two-part mm-hmm. question. Can you give us a synopsis of The Black Sail? But first, what prompted you to name your book The Black Sail?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, The Black Sail is, for me, a double or maybe even a triple entendre. The book is really about a group of people who come together to form the Black resistance movement. And in that sense, it is a cell. It is a group of people. But we also know that the prison cell is a place that was created by and large for Black and brown people to inhabit. And so the idea that we can use the word cell that is intended to be a place where we are taken and broken, because we know that the prison industrial complex gains its millions of dollars on the backs of Black and brown people. So we know that there is that idea of a cell is someplace that was created for us after enslavement. Right? It's a continuation of the free labor that we provided, the exploited labor that we provided during slavery. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I think is, I was thinking about with the cell, is that when you think about a battery, batteries contain cells and they power objects. Well, in this case, the Black Cell powers a movement. It is really about, this book is about Black power. A lot of books are written about Black pain. But this particular book is about Black power. And so the idea of the cell was, you know, multiple uses of plays on the same word.
Mm. Wow.
So about how I started this, how I wrote the book. Is that where I should go next? Or an overview of the book?
Yes. The floor is yours. I really want you to enlighten.
Okay.
Yes, enlighten the listeners of what they have in store for them as it relates to this to your book, The Black Cell.
Absolutely. So I will say that this book, I am pretty unapologetic that I have written it for Black people and for others who are interested in Black liberation. So the book really is focused on how do we get to the point of being liberated as a people. It is a fictional tale set in 2024, so very near future. And it really is asks the question of how do we gain our liberation? Are we able to gain our liberation through peaceful means only, or is it going to require violence as our ancestors have experienced? The book is really about four main characters who really are composites of people I know. There is very little in this book that is made up, as you have already said. It's, a lot of it is based on either on history or on current events. For these four young people, one is a young man, they're all Black, one is a young man who watched his mother go to jail because he had a bad experience at school and his mother went up to protect him and she got put in jail for standing up for her child. And another young woman who has had a baby and is really sort of struggling. But I wanted to get inside the story of the stereotypes of young Black women who've had babies and are single mothers. This whole stereotype and narrative about young women like this, but how many people really know their story? And so sharing her story. And then there are two other Black people who are Black that really have believed that their education and their socioeconomic status can save them from racism. And they've had to learn in very difficult ways that that is not the case. So this book is set in 2024, and it is right before the election. And there is a white nationalist demagogue who is up for election, and the country has already had its first Black president, and we have seen that not very much changed for Black people, even though we had a president in the White House. But as a result of having a president in the White House, there was a backlash by white nationalists, which we have seen in real life, right? And they elected a white nationalist demagogue. But in response, the Black people in this country decided to come together to really fight this white nationalism that was rising in the country. And it's really a story of building community. You've already talked about the importance of relationships. It is, somebody told me that it is a roadmap for how we can envision what liberation could look like for us. It is a roadmap because before we can actually walk the road, we have to be able to envision. And so this idea of sharing resources, living in a collectivist community the way our ancestors did back in Africa, in the Caribbean, and where that has been stripped from us in this country in so many ways. And in this book, we get that back. We reclaim our community. We reclaim our relationships. We take care of our own people so that we create a web for Black people where nobody's hungry and nobody is unhoused. And people have what they need because we really do have enough to go around. It's a matter of figuring out how do we spread the care and the love within our community. And at the same time, this white nationalist fervor is growing in the country. And, and I don't want to spoil the whole book, but this white nationalist does get elected, and it really swings the country into a type of chaos. It is a series, so it is the first book in the series, but they are created to be able to stand alone. And I just want to tell you one other little quick thing that really I thought about a lot when I started writing this book. My family's from Jamaica, West Indies, and I went home to Jamaica in 2020 to visit my 90-year-old aunt, who since has passed on, so I'm very grateful that I had that opportunity. And one of her caretakers, a young woman, who was there to, you know, take care of her, help her. I was sitting and talking to her, and so she was asking me a lot of questions about living in the United States. And she said to me, why don't the Black people rise up and fight? And I thought, oh, that's a, you know, that is a very sort of simplistic view of what is happening in this country. It is so much more complicated than that. And so that is true. And at the same time, I realized that the reason she is thinking about the about rising up and fighting is because in this country, so much of our history has been squashed and flattened in the school. And so our children aren't being taught about all the slave rebellions. They're not being taught in school in great detail about Nat Turner and Sam Sharp and about Marcus Garvey's writings and about the Black Panthers and the importance of groups like the Nation of Islam. We're not hearing, our children are not learning about what it means to really mount up a resistance against white supremacy. And so how will they, without a sense of our history as a people, how do we get to the point where we can really make decisions about how we become liberated, how we liberate ourselves? And so in this book, sort of rolling through this book is a lot of history. And a lot of, and what people have told me is that, oh, they've learned history they didn't know. So I'm an immigrant to this country. So I had to learn a lot of the history in this country, and I'm still learning. But history is, as Marcus Garvey said, history is the point on which our future spins, right? So if we don't understand our history, we cannot understand our future. And so I've woven a lot of history into this book so that we can begin to envision a path forward. Then it's up to us to decide whether we're going to take it or not.
That's very powerful. You know, your book, as you were speaking about the dynamics of your book, Liberation, which I feel liberation is much more powerful than emancipation. Because when we think about the Emancipation Proclamation, so-called, it just transferred into the 13th Amendment, which allowed slavery to continue in the form of mass incarceration through the prison industrial complex. So therefore, emancipation to me is much more temporal as opposed to liberation, which is much more thorough and non-matter of fact. It leaves nothing to the imagination. As you were speaking about your book, it's almost like though we're talking about two different scripts entirely, but it made me think about The Purge, but differently, the movie The Purge. And if you remember the last movie, The Purge, that which was called the first purge, that led to many purges, but the first purge was based in the projects to destroy Black people and how they set up various medical centers, sort of like now with the vaccinations. But if you participate in this purge program, which is mandated by the government, you can carry out all of your aggression and all of your murder, whatever you want to do on that day, you can do it and not suffer any penalty, but in fact, get rewarded. So, so your book is like the polar opposite. What you're talking about is a liberation from the annihilation that we have endured, but that we have psychologically taken on in the form of trauma. To purge ourselves of that, as opposed to Hollywood's rendition of what they have done and what they continue to do to us, even as we speak.
That's right.
So the Black...
That's right. And
No, go right ahead, man.
I'm just agreeing with you. I think that is so true. And there is a level of pain that this society likes to see Black people in. There is a level of pain that is, I often liken it to porn. It is something that is self-gratifying, that people watch, it gratifies you. You know, you can take it all in and just keep on taking more of it in. You don't know, whether it's impacting you or not, but it is this sort of like constant stream of images and which cause emotion of Black people being harmed or being powerless. I mean, when you look at movies, you look at over and over again, you see it in depictions of Black communities. It's just pain, 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 pain. And it's true that we do have pain, but we also have power. And I really want us to tell the story of our power so that people can understand that we are, first of all, we're not a monolith. There's just not, that's the other thing about the book. I talk a lot about the whole diaspora because there are so many of us with so many different gifts. We're greater than our pain. We are powerful. We are beautiful. We are able to do things and change things for ourselves. And so when you talk about sort of this ongoing image of Black people being purged and Black people being hurt, well, I wanted to offer a counter narrative to that. And so, yes, there are lots of images of pain in the book, but they're countered, they're balanced by images of Black people doing amazing things and supporting each other and creating a society where we can be self-determined and self-sufficient.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And with that being said, I want to read an excerpt from your book, and I want you to kind of unpack this for us, you know, as we continue to talk about trauma, because that's the premise of this podcast in dealing with trauma. And here from the Black Cell says that Corey knew when he had heard sirens and saw red and blue lights heading toward the school that it was bad. And when it came to bad things between Black people and white people, the Black people usually lost. Calvin came home fighting back tears. He wouldn't say what he saw, just that they took Mom away in handcuffs. And the principal told him to go home before school ended. We go on and on. This seems to be a common thing, a theme in many of our communities, certainly in our schools, this type of compounded trauma. Can you speak to that particular scene that I just read and how that is applicable right here, right now in 2022?
Absolutely. So I want to go back a little bit before that scene. So what happened was that Corey's uncle was shot the night before. And as so often it happens in so many of our communities, children experience a trauma, the family's going through an entire situation. Kids get up and go to school the next morning, right? They show up in school, but they are devastated. And they don't know how to share that they're devastated. And there may not be anybody at the school who cares that they're devastated or may ask for, they know well enough. And so in this situation, Corey is really upset about the death of his uncle. And he goes to school, but his body is there, but his mind is not there. He's just not there. And he's sitting in his desk just trying to be there, but he really is in his thoughts about this grief he's having. And so his teacher comes over and she is demanding that he sit up straight and he pay attention. And she goes into this whole slew of accusations about him, that he's lazy, that he doesn't care about school, all of these things. But meanwhile, this kid is just trying to figure out how it is that his closest male relative has been killed. And so he absolutely flips out, right? We know this happens a lot for kids who have experienced trauma, and they go to school and something happens and it's just a catalyst. And he goes flying out of the school house. So he's just really angry, really upset. And he decides to remove himself before he does something, hit somebody or the teacher or something. So he leaves. The teacher tells him to get out of the classroom. He leaves the school. But the teacher has put her hands on him. she actually ripped his sweatshirt off him. And so he goes home, and his mother comes home, and she's like, where's the sweatshirt you left for school? Where? So he tells her the story. So his mother, who went to the same school as a child and experienced similar things, right? So she, we've got multi-generational trauma, right, from being at the school. And mom decides, no, absolutely not. You are not doing this to my children. You all did this to me. You're not doing this to my children. And she goes marching up to the school to give them a piece of her mind. When she gets up there, she's talking to the teacher, and she jabs her forefinger at the teacher's chest as she's talking to her. She's making a point. And she gets arrested. And that starts this whole series of events where, you know, as you know, so many cities require cash bail. And we know that a lot of people stay in jail for a very long time because they can't afford cash bail. And so this is what happens to Corey's mother. And she is in jail. And when she comes out of jail, she is a different person. She has experienced such intense trauma. She was this bright and vibrant woman who was a very important part of her community. And she goes to jail for jabbing her finger at this white teacher's chest. And she's in jail for 5 years. And then she comes out, and Corey has basically lost his mother. She's a shell of a woman. And so we look at this compounded trauma that Corey experiences. And then later on, he goes on to have his own run-in with the police, where he ends up in prison, in jail for 4 days for something he had nothing to do with. And so we can see how we have this sort of buildup of compounded trauma that then begins to really impact everything in this young man's life.
I mean, this is taking place even as we speak. You know, as you were speaking, you know, doctor, it's almost like this compounded, this complex compounded trauma. It has never been addressed to the magnitude of how it was enforced, placed upon us.
Yeah.
I mean, even when we talk about chattel slavery, that trauma was never addressed. When we talk about the Reconstruction period, in which we gained footing politically in this country, but still never dealing with the chattel slavery, that trauma was not addressed. Jim Crow and the various lynchings, that trauma was not addressed. Moving into the civil rights era, mass incarceration during the Nixon administration, and certainly the quote unquote first black president that many deemed to be not Barack Obama, but Bill Clinton, who locked up more black people than both Reagan and Bush combined, that level of trauma.
Right.
So when I hear your book, it covers so many dimensions and various levels, but one is a call to aftercare trauma support and care for those who have been incarcerated, those that who have been affected by violence, but there is very little trauma support in your area of Baltimore. Do you see a high volume or lack thereof when it comes to aftercare for trauma support?
There's not enough, that's for sure. Everybody recognizes the need, but there isn't enough support to go around. We continue to see children who experience trauma in their communities caused by the history we have a lot of it, started with racialized housing covenants in Baltimore. You know, we led the nation with redlining, and we taught the rest of the country how to do redlining, so we do it really well. And so we really do see the impact, of those historic policies, which the policies may be off the books, and the laws may be off the books, but the practices are still very much alive and well. And so we continue to see children experiencing intense trauma. I mean, a lot of the trauma that we see that I have coined a term that I use in my writing called socially engineered trauma. And socially engineered trauma is to be differentiated from randomly occurring trauma. Because the truth is that in the cities in which many of us work, especially cities that are mostly black and brown, very little of the trauma people experience is randomly occurring. And when I say randomly occurring, meaning that any person has an equal opportunity of experiencing that trauma. We know that there are certain traumas that women are more likely to experience, and we know that there are a lot of socially engineered traumas that that Black people experience in their communities. For goodness sake, even a natural disaster like Hurricane Katrina did not result in randomly occurring trauma. There were specific traumas that people who were Black experienced, even though everybody was in the same hurricane, right? We know that if you were poor, you were Black, or you were one of those Vietnamese fishermen, that your chances of being unhoused for week to week was great. We know that there were places that Black people who were trying to escape the rising waters were not permitted to go, but there were white people with guns standing out there, stopping them from entering their communities. So there is very little trauma that I see on a regular basis that occurs randomly. We know that incarceration in our community has absolutely decimated families. We know it has decimated communities. And there is this ripple effect that continues for generations and generations. So in my work, what we are trying to do is to figure out how do we really halt that level of trauma? How do we interrupt the trauma? And there are ways that we can do it, trying to really change policies and laws and practices. But what we really believe at the end of the day is that the people who are most impacted by trauma, they have to recognize their power. They have to be able to, you can't go back necessarily and change everything that has happened to you in the past. But you can certainly, as you said, we are responsible for our own healing. But people need tools to heal. And they need space and they need community. And so if we can build community where everybody has what they need and people have the opportunities they need to be able to have well-being and self-power and agency and community, then we know that the people who are most impacted by that trauma, they will have a great opportunity to change what happens in their own families and in their own communities. It's really very difficult for people outside to change that. All other people can do is facilitate and support. But the people who are experiencing the trauma are the ones who have the power.
Absolutely. You know, that's a perfect segue for this question for you. Do you think that Black people have the ability or the agency to build a safe and loving and supportive community? And if so, how does that look?
I absolutely think Black people have the ability. I think that we have the ability to build strong communities. Look, in our DNA is a collectivist mindset from our mother Africa. We came from a group of people who lived together, who supported each other, where there was a village mentality, community mentality. And we had that for a long time. And when we think about how communities lived in the South before the massive migration to the North, people lived in communities where, you know, it was not uncommon for a child to be living next to a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer who looked like them. You know, they got to see within their own community all the things they could be, all the opportunities they could be, and they knew that there was a Miss So-and-so down the street that if she saw you doing something you weren't supposed to do, she was going to pull you up. She was not going to let something happen to you. She was not going to stand by and watch that, right? So we have that in our DNA. What has happened is that we have been taught to model ourselves after the individualist framework of Europeans. We've been taught to think about how do I get mine and how do I, you know, build my family and support my family. And so we are all of us on this treadmill of trying to sort of make it. And it can be hard to think in that way and still remember all of our collectivist values. We've got to go back to where we came from. We've got to go back to the days where we supported each other. I want to tell you something just really quick story. When my family came to this country, we came with not very much money. And, you know, we were immigrants and we were, you know, Black immigrants. So you can imagine that this country does not welcome us the same way it did immigrants coming from Europe. Mm-hmm. But we got here and my Jamaican family decided to do something that is something that we have done that we brought from West Africa as a people, which is this idea of community wealth building called SUSU. And some communities call it partner. And what a SUSU is that you may get 10 families together and they decide they're going to build a community and they are going to put their money into a collective pot. And so if it's $50 a week, everybody's putting their $50 a week in, it's a pot of $500, if it's, you know, a 5-10 families, and then the pot goes around every week, and then you get your $500, and then you can do what you want with it, because we understood that we did not trust that. And so my family wanted to build a business, but they knew they would never get a loan from a bank. So what they did was they created a partnership, and they kept the money pot going for years and years. And they built up enough money to buy two vacant and abandoned apartment buildings in New York. And then on the weekends, everybody was out there working. I come from a family of laborers. My father's an electrician. I have uncles who are plumbers and carpenters. Everybody was out there working. And we created, you know, we built up these apartments and they rented those apartments. Now, my parents died before they ever saw any of the fruits of that labor. Yeah. But you want to talk about intergenerational wealth building. When those buildings were sold, I got a little teeny piece of that money to be able to buy my house. My family doesn't have intergenerational wealth. But we can create that as a community. We can care for each other. There are ways that we can build together. And so what's needed is relationship and trust. And it can be done. So absolutely, I believe it. I absolutely believe it. I'm waiting for us to get there as a people. There are pockets of this happening. I want to be really clear that this is not something that's coming out of Wendy's head. This is happening in different places. I just want to see it spread and grow.
Absolutely. I think that's really amazing what you're talking about as far as what your family instituted, which some refer to as family banking. Even when you look at most wealthy people, that they may have bank accounts, but the bulk of their money is in insurance policies and able to pull that money out, and mm-hmm. they start their own family bank that way. And I think that's really amazing. Mm-hmm. of the legacy and the pedigree that you come from, which is indicative of writing the Black Sail, but also just your whole school of thought in that particular area. Mm-hmm. I guess my final question to you, how can we collectively, but I don't know if we can collectively do it without first individually, but how can we collectively or individually overcome generational shame, stigma and self-hatred? And we see this self-hatred, we cannot deny it, social media, this inflamed or perpetrated gender war that we have going on, that others are benefiting from our ignorance and our demise. But how can we overcome this generational shame, stigma and self-hatred? What are some practical ways that we can do this?
So I am a student of anti-racism from wherever I can learn it. And so I was in a workshop once with where we were learning about Baltimore's history of racism. And there was a young woman in there in the workshop who had, and I talk about her all the time with her permission, who had been raised in foster care. And she talked about, and so she sat there, she listened to this whole history of what has happened in Baltimore. And then when the trainers finished talking about it, she said, you know, I've never heard this history before. So I've grown up and I felt closer to white people than I did to my own people because I thought they were trifling. I felt shame because of the way, you know, some of the things that my family, you know, went through, and I was removed from my family. She said, but this is the first time anybody has ever explained to me the structural and systemic landscape that my family was part of, this environment that impacted them. And she said, and I can finally forgive my mother. Mm. And it was such a profound moment. And I kept thinking, so you mean all of the social workers that she has come into contact with, not one single one of them told her this story. What they told her was a narrative that really supported the idea that Black people are somehow, by our very nature, intrinsically flawed and inferior. And she had grown up with this idea, and she had this wealth of shame. So, you know, I am a big believer in getting to know our history. So I created a framework that we use in our therapeutic work called SHARP, and I write about it. And SHARP is an acronym that stands for structural oppression, historical context. So understanding the structural oppression in the communities in which you're working and how it's impacting people in that community. Historical context, really understanding the history of the community. Because we can't, in any society that ignores its history is destined to repeat it. So we must know our history. The A is for analysis of role, meaning that as we are working, those of us who are in the place of working with people who have been impacted by trauma, we've got to decide on a day-to-day basis what our role is going to be in this work. Are we going to be disrupting the status quo, or are we going to be maintaining it? Disruption is painful and difficult. So if you don't know what you're doing, you are maintaining the status quo, which means that you are not doing anything to disrupt the shame and self-blame that people are walking through this life with. The R is for reciprocity and mutuality, the idea that everybody has something to give, everybody has something meaningful to share, and that as we work with people, we have to be in reciprocal relationships with them. There are two-way relationships where people understand that they have something to give everybody around them, and that we must live in mutuality, that we must work together to get to our collective, and this is what the P is, which is power, and understanding that people do have power. Those of us who work with, facilitate trauma work, it is our job to help people to understand their power and where their power lies. And what we have found is that as people begin to walk in their power, even if they've experienced trauma, there is something that allows them to shake off some of that shame. Because it's very different to think that the situation you are in is because you have somehow done something wrong. When people begin to understand that there's a structural element going on here and that there are things that they have experienced that they did not cause, it changes the way they see themselves. It changes the shame and the self-blame, and they begin to go, this is bigger than me. This is something that has impacted me, and I didn't create it. What am I going to do about it now that I know that?
Absolutely. Wow, and it's that empowerment that eradicates that victimized mentality that we can't do it. Mm-hmm. I'm just hopeless. I'm helpless. But in fact, we have the power right. That's on the inside of us to move to a much better place of inner healing.
Absolutely. In this society, infantilizes Black people, right? This society treats Black people as if we are children, we are helpless, we can't figure things out for ourselves, and that is the farthest from the truth. We are powerful. We are powerful because God made us powerful. Just by that very nature alone, we are powerful, and it's really important for each one of us to recognize that and figure out how to use our power.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Shia, how can people get in contact with you? Where can they purchase the book? I know that you're all over the social media platforms, and this book drops on 9/27. 9/27, that's easy to remember.
That's right.
So how can they get the book, and how can they get in contact with you? If, in fact, maybe they want to bring you to their school, they want to bring you to a faith-based organization to be able to speak, how can they make that happen?
Absolutely. So the book is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. So you can find it on Amazon. You can find it online at Barnes & Noble. If your local bookstore doesn't have it, you can simply request it. They will get it. And then if you want to reach me, you can go to my website, www.wendyshia.com. That's W-E-N-D-Y. sasamhaia.com. And you can send me a message on there. I will say that I do really want to come and join book clubs virtually. So if you happen to have a book club, drop me a note on my website and I will join your book club virtually and we can have a discussion about the book.
Awesome. And just one final question, I guess, final thoughts as it relates to the Black Sail, as it relates to your body of work. What are some of the things, or what is the chief thing that you want to leave as far as in this earth, an unshakable and an unbreakable legacy that someone will be able to take that mantle and be able to run to the next level, not of emancipation, but of liberation?
Wow, that is a great question. There is a saying by I want to make sure I get his name right, Amir Baraka, that says, "Turn their faces towards the light, so the beautiful can see themselves and recognize their own beauty." My goal with writing fiction is to hold up a mirror, to turn people's faces towards the light so that they can see themselves as beautiful and powerful and able to come up with solutions together in community. If there is nothing else I leave on this earth, if that is the only thing that I leave, that is, you know, people start seeing themselves as not just people who are experiencing what is happening in the world, but people who are changing what is happening in the world, agents of change, I would be satisfied by that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Agent of change, you know, immortal words of Tupac, yeah. Each one teach one. Author Dr. Yes. Wendy Shire, we thank you so much for joining us on the Shame Free Life Radio Show. It has been a pleasure and an honor. I want everyone out there to run out and get this book, whether you download it by way of Kindle, or if you are a page turner like myself, and we like to write in the book like a workbook, marking up stuff, go ahead and purchase that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no better investment than in ourselves. We buy Stacey Graff, we buy Tom Clancy, and even that demonic Stephen King. But when it comes to our own, that will challenge us mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and financially, it's always crickets, and we want to change that. So I thank you so much, Dr. Shire. I'm looking forward to having you back on, and all your information is out there. We salute you, we support you, and we thank the Most High Yahweh for you, because you are a trailblazer and not a pathfinder. And until next time, as I always say on Shame Free Life Podcast Radio Show, that your life begins when you say so.
Thank you for joining us on the Shame Free Life Radio Show for 15 Minutes of Shame. Follow us on IG and Twitter at Shame Free Life. For information on promoting your business with us, contact us at theshamefreelife@gmail.com. Until next time, your life begins when you say so.